Hello and welcome back to A Better World. This is your host, Mitchell J. Rabin, and I'm very glad that you're joining us again today. Today we're going to be exploring a very important subject, that is the subject of saltwater plants as part of the planet's future food source. Now, we'll learn today through our guest, Dennis Bushnell of NASA, that it's a whole lot more than just food for our bodies. It's actually very much a streamlined way of dealing with the most essential issues facing mankind right now, which many of us agree is the issue surrounding global warming. So through today's show, we will be going through first an understanding of what these saltwater plants are, known as halophytes. Dennis has done an extraordinary amount of work on this because his work at NASA is largely about having technical oversight about advanced programming in regard to solutions to environmental issues that are challenging us today. So Dennis Bushnell has received numerous awards for his work. He has been promoted to do this research that I'm describing, as well as into low-energy nuclear reactions, known as cold fusion, and many other aspects of using energy resourcefully, sustainably, renewably, and wisely. And along that path, he has done a tremendous amount of looking into halophytes and the series of solutions that they provide us today. So some of the mystery of this large, complex issue called global warming as a result of mounting greenhouse gases, of pollution, and the issues that are generating accelerated climate change can actually be largely answered and solved in what Dennis has been uncovering, studying, researching, and will today in our show bringing to the fore. So welcome, Dennis. Great to have you on the show today, A Better World.
It's an honor and a privilege.
So thank you. If you would, please, for our audience, just lay out a description and a definition of halophytes. It's a word that most people probably don't even know. I mean, it was only a year or two ago, thanks to the work that you did with Hazel Henderson, that I heard it myself. So if you would please start there.
Phytes are plants, and freshwater plants are called glycophytes, and saltwater plants are called halophytes. Halo means salt, so salt plants. These are land plants and also ocean plants, and I'm going to be discussing the situation with respect to land plants. The land plants grow on deserts and wastelands. 44% of the land is deserts and wastelands, and some 97%
of our planet
water,
currently.
Pardon?
44% is desert. 44% as things stand
currently,
right now.
44% of the dry land mass is the deserts and wastelands. 97% of the water is saline seawater, and seawater, because everything drains into seawater, contains 80% of the nutrients to grow plants, so you need very little fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's massive potential capacity with all this land and all this water, cheap land, cheap water. There's nearly 10,000 natural halophytes that grow on deserts and wastelands and can provide food. There are halophytes within this 10,000 that are greens, grains, tubers, fruits, nuts, wood, berries, and they're used for animal fodder and have been in many countries, including the shore versions of India for, you know, hundreds of years for food and animal fodder. And also biomass, which does not use fresh water and arable land, massive amounts of biomass for biofuels. And also the biomass can be used for chemical feedstock to replace petroleum for plastics. In terms
of food... So are you saying that we could have a halophyte-based substance that replaces the use of plastics?
You can have a plastic that's based on halophytes instead of petroleum.
So it wouldn't have the non-biodegradable problems we have with petroleum-based plastics?
You can produce plastics from this biomass to have any properties that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, chemistry can
mm-hmm.
do that. It's just a matter of, which plastics are used when for what is often as much a matter of financial as it is chemical capability.
Okay, so it's usually more based on financial expediency and profit than it is on the ability to create biodegradable materials.
Okay. In terms of food, halophyte agriculture, using ultra-cheap land and saline seawater, this would ensure using little fertilizer that we will not run out of food for many hundreds of years. The current arable land is some 11% of the land, and I just said previously that the deserts and wastelands where we can grow halophytes is 44% of the land. So therefore, this is four times more land than the current arable land where we do freshwater agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Deserts, wastelands, and seawater is really the last major natural resource available to humans on Earth. And it's a really massive one. Nominally, halophyte nutritional value is similar to freshwater plants, except that seawater contains trace nutrients like selenium that we now have to take in vitamin form because we have denuded these trace elements from the current arable land. We've overused the arable land. When
so,
you irrigate the seawater, you get these back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, understood.
Okay, then growing
halophytes. Are there some examples that are commonly known, Dennis, that are halophytes but known by other names? That are in our food supply right now?
The most expensive food, green food, in Europe and particularly in the Netherlands is a halophyte. I'm not I haven't kept up with the commercial names of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But halophytes are nascent in terms of going to the store and buying them now. Probably the most prevalent halophyte is the fact that the Japanese have been eating seaweed for a long time. All right, seaweed is a halophyte. It just grows in the ocean instead of on land.
Yes. So you've got land-based and you've got sea-based. I would imagine, is one of
them. I'm talking about
the
land-based. You can always mm-hmm. do aquaculture and do a sea-based also.
Yes.
Growing halophytes is essentially the same as freshwater farming, except, as I said, far less fertilizer is needed. And you also have to add some 35% more water, seawater, cheap water, to flush the salt back into the sandy soils, and it eventually goes back into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
The potential food generating capacity exceeds by a factor of four what we now produce, there is, of course, far more seawater than there is freshwater. So.
Mm-hmm.
You asked me, what were the downsides?
Yes.
The one is...
Are there downsides? And if so, what are they? Right?
One is there are no current seed catalogs, like the Burpee seed catalogs, that people can go on the web, buy the seeds, and grow halophytes. The halophytes are used now in 22 different countries for food and fodder, but there is no, not yet a commercial agriculture for halophytes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So in other words, it's very early stage for that, is what you're kind of implying.
Due to much lower cost, because these deserts and wastelands are generally in sunny areas with a lot of solar energy available, due to cheap land and cheap water, the current, this is the other downside, the current freshwater agriculture industry is being very challenged by this. The situation is similar to the renewable energy business, where which is winning now over first coal and now gas and petroleum due to cost. Okay, the renewables are much cheaper, but the entrenched industries over the past several decades have fought this change, you know, all the way along, and these are very powerful people. So those are the only downsides that I'm aware of. As we're running out of food and fresh water, we will have to go to halophytes, and I'll give you another reason in a little while. Halophytes can replace with the saltwater agriculture the 70% of the fresh water that's now used for conventional freshwater agriculture. So we're running out of fresh water. And a part of a major reason for that is we need to use all this fresh water for agriculture. So if we switch to
animal
saltwater agriculture, you know, all of that fresh water is available, and we're no longer running out of fresh water for direct human use. As I said, currently some 22 nations are pursuing halophytes for food and for animal fodder. I have worked with Boeing. Boeing is now producing aircraft fuel from halophytes grown in the United Arab Emirates. And also friends of mine are growing airplane fuel via halophytes in farms in northern Mexico. The halophytes would green huge areas, which are now brown, and they sequester some 18% of their CO2 uptake in their deep desert roots. And the saline water evaporates as fresh water and produces an unstable atmosphere and freshwater rain where there's now no rain. So if as we do this in northern Africa, the Sahara, this would stop the desertification of the sub-Sahara and put rainfall back in the Middle East and regrow the cedars of Lebanon. Overall, and you know, absolutely with respect to capability and capacity and cost, halophytes can, in 5 to 10 years, with current technology, affordably solve, not play with, solve land, water, food, energy, and climate. Nothing else comes anywhere close, is in the same league with this massive capacity. For freshwater agriculture, we have pumped much of the freshwater aquifers, and what's left in the aquifers is increasingly saline. So as we pump that increasingly saline water onto freshwater agriculture land, that land's becoming salinated. So we'll have to switch to halophytes, okay, going forward, even for the arable.
Anyway. But
okay.
Am I right if I hear you saying here, Dennis, that the process of vaporization is almost the plant acting as a desalination system naturally?
No. The plants have, depending on species, two or three different ways to isolate the salt. You know, that's the characteristic of a halophyte. The evaporation is a simply solar evaporation. In other words, as you irrigate land, the water evaporates, and it also evaporates off of the leaves of the plants, which is far more fresh than what you irrigated it with.
Okay. But what I mean is what I'm hearing is that by the increased use of halophytes, then the freshwater reserves will be able to be utilized for direct human and other application instead of for irrigation purposes and agriculture.
Yes. because to the extent that you replace halophytes with arable land, current freshwater agriculture. Now, just like the carbon-based, you know, energy fought the renewables, okay, I fully expect that the freshwater agriculture is going to fight halophyte agriculture.
You mean just on an economic, political level?
Yes.
But short of that, from a pure ecological, systemic, and scientific point of view, the halophyte has it far over the use of fresh water-based agriculture.
Yes, to the extent that you can have sources of salt water, okay, which are in some proximity. Most of the desert areas are, in fact, near salt water. The Atacama in Chile, the southwest U.S., the Sahara all around the Middle East, the Arabian Sea, these are the major desert areas, and they're huge. We did some just for the Sahara, and you can, on the Sahara, replace all the petrochemical feedstock for plastics. You can replace all of the fossil carbon that's left, because we now generate 25% of electricity from renewables anyway, and that's going to go way up as we go forward. So
those 22 countries that you referenced, are those largely in the African Union and the Middle East? Do you want to name a few of them?
They're all over the place. And in fact, some of them are island nations. I spent some time working with the government of the Netherlands, the plenipotentiary that is responsible for Aruba. Okay, the Netherlands owns Aruba, which you may have heard of. This is a desert island. The upwind portion, the eastern portion of the island, is nothing but a desert. And Aruba has to import all of their water. They have to import all of their fuel. And if they grew halophytes on their eastern version, eastern region, they could grow their fuel and also grow food and don't have to import the water.
I mean, now you mean Aruba in the Caribbean?
Yes.
Oh, my. So then what goes for Aruba would also go for the other Caribbean island nations as well?
Oh, yes. So, well, I mean, some of them have some rain. Okay, Haiti has some rain in the mountains, and Cuba has some in their mountains.
Overall,
a great many nations, are adjacent to salt water, and that includes all kinds of lakes which are salty. However, on the Sahara, there are huge under the desert aquifers, especially the Nubian aquifer, which is in the eastern end of the Sahara, with a huge capacity. You could do halophyte agriculture on the Sahara without pumping the Mediterranean or the North Atlantic. You could just pump the Nubian aquifer for about 50 or 60 years.
My
God. And you have all of this nice, cheap photovoltaics, which, as we discussed previously, is now down to 2 cents a kilowatt hour and dropping like a stone. To do the pumping. So, our estimates of the cost of doing halophyte agriculture is far less than freshwater agriculture.
Fascinating. And as I mentioned to you earlier about wind technology I'm working with now that drops the cost to not only under a penny, actually. I didn't tell you the whole truth. It's actually to about a third of a penny per kilowatt hour. But, it seems so extraordinary, I don't even like to share that with people. But, yes, I mean, overall, there is this profound reduction in the cost of renewable energies, as it should be, and it is happening to the point that they are, no pun intended, trumping the the fossil fuel market tremendously, and we're observing a radical change in the economics involved here. It's fantastic. Have you done the arithmetic, Dennis, about what would occur if there was truly a greening of the current deserts, the large land masses of desert like the Sub-Sahara, Africa, etc., and how that would shift the issue of global warming, because the oxygen levels would be restored and the sequestration levels would be increased?
All right, let me start from the basics. Over the centuries, as a CO2 has been produced, it was fairly stable for a long time, because about half of it would go into the forests and the land plants, and the other half would go into the ocean. There has now been so much that the ocean has taken up that it's turned the oceans into weak carbonic acid, and the ocean uptake is dropping. And of course, weak carbonic acid is killing the algae and all kinds of other problems. But then we're cutting down the forest. We are now cutting down the forest. So the CO2, you know, not only are we putting out tremendous amounts of CO2, some 100 times greater than the CO2 from the Siberian Traps volcanoes that instituted the Permian extinction, the Great Dying. But we have now shorted on the CO2 uptake. The halophytes would green areas where we've cut down the forest, and at one time the Sahara was a green area, and we can regreen that. There are still some issues about if you make all of these nice, cool, green things to take care of warming, you know, what do you do to weather and global circulation? That we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Is there a hypothesis of what would happen if
don't know, because it's a very nonlinear system.
Yes. But if is there anything in the exploration of halophytes that you've encountered, Dennis, that would have some effect on the melting of the ice caps and the permafrost?
The melting.
Why not have fun and go for broke?
the melting is a function of two things. One is the CO2 in the atmosphere, which is affected by all the stuff we've been discussing and more, and that whole climate change is now accelerated by what are called positive feedbacks. There is five major positive feedbacks which we have now triggered and are starting up, and that's why the actual changes are running at the top of or greater than the IPCC projections. And that includes the fossil methane, which is coming out of the tundra, which is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. So methane is 22 times worse than CO2. So it's a lot more
times?
Than just the CO2. It's now the methane.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of other stuff.
I've heard between 75 and 100 times worse, so it's interesting to hear you say 22. So I guess maybe there is a bit of a range.
Yeah, it's 22 to 28. I've not seen a credible number higher than that, unless they're talking about secondary effect. Now, what's interesting
is... So talking about those positive feedback loops, are you saying that even with the institution of halophytes en masse, those five feedback loops will kind of continue because it's a nonlinear system and it's going to take even a whole lot more than maybe we've even conceived to reverse those loops?
The people that published the estimates just came out a couple weeks ago and said, well, the water rise isn't going to be what we told you. It's going to be twice that. People have done guesstimates of these positive feedbacks. I've only discussed one. There's five of them. And their effects are the order of, some have guesstimated, twice what the IPCC projections are. And so, and, you know, that's not pleasant.
Right. To put it mildly.
The glaciers in the Himalaya areas feed almost all of the major Eurasian rivers, from the Indus and the Ganges and the Brahmaputra around to the Mekong to the Yellow and the Yangtze and so forth. As those glaciers melt, and they're melting fast now, 1/6 of the world's population will lose their fresh water.
Oh, God.
It's astounding.
Staggering.
As you say, look at the nonlinear aspects and so forth.
Yes. Yes. So when you say
the Permian is known as the Great Dying, and it was triggered by massive Siberian volcanoes, but what ended up killing, why it's called the Great Dying, why it ended up killing about 96% of the species, is that the ocean thermohaline circulators died. The Gulf Stream and others are starting to slow down now.
Mm-hmm.
And as they died, the oceans went anoxic, low oxygen. And that allowed the overgrowth of cyanobacteria, i.e. anoxic algae, which then produced massive amounts of hydrogen sulfide, the rotten egg gas. And in a small percentage in the atmosphere, this is a deadly poison. And also, all that sulfur went up and took down the ozone layer. And that's evidently what ended up, warming in climate is far more than a warm day and wet feet. This is existential.
Surely, surely. No, this is a threat to life as we know it from beginning to end. This is why it conjures, and many scientists have said that the sixth extinction is underway. And these are the signs and symptoms. It's not like it's something that may happen. It is already underway. So when you make the statement that the institution implementation of halophytes en masse could actually reverse this serious and actually somewhat long-term trend that is a result of anthropogenic activity over the last several hundred years, this is a big, big statement, and that's why I'm looking to uncover the kind of the facts behind that statement.
Well, it's a matter of capacity, okay? A lot of people that work various climate approaches, you know, if they're totally successful, it doesn't move the mark very much. Halophytes have just massive capacity. And, nothing. We have bad problems with the ecosystem crashing. We have bad problems emerging with water and food shortages. People are always looking for land and, energy and so forth. And this will solve land, water, food, energy, and climate at the requisite capacity necessary to do that planet-wise.
How would you describe what that capacity would need to be? Just like there are statements that have been promulgated that we need to plant a certain number of trees per year, you know, something on the order of magnitude of, you know, many billion trees worldwide in order to sequester, to make up for what you were saying before of the oceanic acidification, and that it's already sort of topped out, if you will, the Amazon rainforest due to the actions of so many, from Bolsonaro quite, you know, literally, to many other activities taking place for soybean and cacao and gold mining, et cetera, et cetera. in the Amazon. It's also happening in the Congo, the lungs of the planet.
Oh, all right. What do we need? If we grow halophytes for food, for fodder, for petrochemical feedstock, and for biomass for energy, okay, we will cover the planet green instead of trees.
Mm-hmm. Instead of. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's quicker and easier, you're also saying. Sure, sure. I mean, it's virtually immediate. Virtually.
Yes.
Yeah. What do you see as the generator of this? I'm sure you don't see it as government, seeing as you work for government, but business, I take it.
Well, the
joint venture.
This is, I think, a very interesting financial situation.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about, you know, how much does an acre of land in the middle of the Sahara cost? Right? It's pretty cheap. How much does seawater cost compared to freshwater? And it turns out as we pump the atmosphere and, pump the aquifers and, left the saline water and 97% of the water is seawater. The other 2.5% is freshwater, of which almost all of it is tied up in the Great Lakes, Lake Baikal, glaciers, the ice at in Antarctica, and in underground rivers and so forth. Okay, the amount of water that we end up dealing with is in the
it's fractional. Hello? Oh, it looks like we lost the connection to Dennis. I'm sure he'll call in momentarily. So let me take a moment to say that this is Mitchell J. Rabin for A Better World Radio. We're on every week talking with the sung and the unsung heroes of society. We have a free newsletter which you can access and sign up for at www.abetterworld.tv. That's www.abetterworld.tv, although they say that we don't need to say the triple W anymore. So you have it. We're on television every Monday evening in New York City and Manhattan at 7 p.m., although you can also watch it through our website, abetterworld.tv. In the upper right-hand corner, it says click to watch. If you get there on a couple of minutes before 7 p.m. EDT, Eastern Standard Time, or Daylight Time, you will be able to watch us from anywhere. So I welcome you to do the same. So I see that Dennis has re-arrived. Dennis, we lost you there for a moment.
Yes, I know. It's the beauty of the electrical atmosphere when it's 100 degrees out.
Yes, exactly. It has some effects on our communication, so I'm glad you're back. So I just did our little occasional advertisement of A Better World, so you're right on time. Pick up where you left off.
All right. Well, I'd forgotten what I was talking about, so ask me something.
Okay, fine, sure. We were looking at the financial potential and opportunity that awaits us.
So I said, ultra-cheap land, ultra-cheap water.
Yes.
The people at University of Nottingham with ways to not have to use nitrogen fertilizer, nitrogen out of the atmosphere. The ubiquity of the availability of this stuff means that you can set yourself up in the agriculture business and do the food, fodder, feedstock, petrochemical feedstock, and energy extremely cheaply.
Yes.
And the markets for all of this are massive, and you you add to the fact that I think an increasing number of people, as climate change has become ever more obvious and ubiquitous and worrisome, would tend to buy from such people.
Absolutely. But, I want to bring up, I think that what you're saying has such great validity and future business potential, and I'm all for it. But one of the things that we find today, even short of development of halophytes as a food source, is that food waste is prevalent across the planet. And the reason that people are food insecure is not because there isn't enough food even as of today, but the political will to get the food that's needed in certain areas to those areas. So how would you address that issue in light of the larger picture?
This has been a perennial problem, particularly in Russia over the years and in other places. And it's a transportation and storage problem and a financial problem.
Yes.
All of those together. And
I would say also a corruption problem with local
that's
officials.
Part of the financial problem.
Yes.
That's really a separate problem from producing this stuff in a climate eco-friendly manner to start with. You know, what the humans do to it afterward is engendered by the humans.
Yes, yes, yes. But from a, from an ecosystemic point of view, which is what we're mainly talking about, and some smart, ambitious entrepreneurs who have the vision to take this halophyte subject and run with it could be doing so much good regarding sequestration of food production, of preserving fresh water sources, of taking the biomass and using it instead of petroleum-based biomass for the development of any number of products, including what we have today as plastics, etc. It's like its own holistic factory, if you will, is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, the issue is that there's an entrenched infrastructure and set of investments which people are very loath to give up. And this has held back renewable energy. It's held back a great many things. We humans evolved over the past million years a part of our brain called the amygdala that keeps us conservative. Some of us, like me, are amygdala deficient, but most people are not. And so change is hard. Okay, any kind of change, good change, bad change, any change is hard. And while the Chinese have a 1,000-year planning cycle and the Japanese 140 years, the U.S. planning cycle is generally the next quarter on Wall Street to the 4-year presidential cycle. It's only when we have a flaming datum, smoking gun, like we do now with climate after decades, that people will seriously start to think about changing things. And then what gets changed is the things that have massive financial benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why renewables are being used, because they're becoming so bloody cheap.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's so interesting that the economic motive, after all, is the thing that will allow for adventure and for change. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought up the amygdala, because that is so much of our issue. You're right. In many ways, it's a biological matter. The brain is designed to keep us alive, of course, from moment to moment, and anything that threatens that becomes problematic. And the system will seek to do what it always did, because it worked already, to maintain survival. So it takes the operation of, let's say, prefrontal cortex to make a different type of executive decision to make another type of effort or take a different type of action. So I'm wholly aligned with you. That's why it's people of greater consciousness, if you will, that are leading the pack in the world of renewable energy and the appreciation of the photon. So, yeah, no, I appreciate that. So what do you see as what can generate the type of interest and excitement in this new space of what you call the last planetary renewable resource?
From my rather extensive experience with the renewable energy journey, I would say someone has to do this. Well, two things. One is you have to establish firmly the need for this, and that's easy.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to then show that this is a real moneymaker by factors of 2 to 5. Okay, big factors. If you can show that, then the first action that needs to be taken is to sponsor research in the agricultural, research institutions to produce the burpee seed catalog, the plants and so forth, and someone puts together a Department of Agriculture circular on the how-to for, you know, halophytes. You need to add some more water. You need to do this. You need to do that. There's not much, but there's a few things.
I'm just so interested in, you know, the idea that Paul Hawkins speaks of reversing global warming. And see, this is a big statement in itself, and his book, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, is it's a profound statement, and it's audacious, and I appreciate it. It speaks about refrigeration management as what scientists worldwide have decided is sort of the most threatening of all and the greatest generator of greenhouse gases. What are your thoughts about that?
We, NASA, I think, did the space research to prove that there was a problem with freons for the ocean hole and all the other business. Refrigeration is part of the issue. A huge percentage of the electricity. Electricity is like 40-45% of the CO2 generation. That's before renewables and so forth. There's another huge percentage of it, which is buildings. That's another 40% of it or so. Then there's the transportation and whatnot, which is another 30 or so. Okay. So the issue with this is how much of this would you address if you did, you know, air conditioning? Air conditioning is part of the 40% that's industrial and other things, and much of that is electric motors.
Buildings.
And buildings, yeah. And a lot of the building, the HVAC stuff, this is electric motors. And electric motors have, over the past 10 years, become far more efficient, and they're still becoming ever more efficient. I personally replaced all of my appliances and washing machines and stuff that had electric motors in them, and I cut my electric bill flat in half. Okay.
Mm. And what did you replace them with? Just more efficient ones?
And, you know, that's only going to get better. So, and in the terms of just of straight air conditioning, there's some Stanford people recently who published a way to use radiation to deep space for air conditioning. Fascinating.
Oh, really? Okay. What? How?
Pardon?
How? How did they use radiation from deep space refrigeration
you
here on planet Earth?
At the right wavelengths.
Okay.
The atmosphere allows transmission of certain wavelengths and not others and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have to take the energy so that it radiates in a wavelength which will go through the atmosphere to deep space.
So you're saying this could be a means of providing refrigeration or air conditioning?
Yes, yes.
An entirely new paradigm of doing so.
Yeah, and it's at the research stage. It's a university research, which I collect. But, there are a great many ways to do things. A lot of the refrigeration is on food, and you can take and process food differently, so you don't need refrigeration. As the climate warms, we're going to have to keep the buildings a little cooler. We can use geothermal and other ways to do that. And cheaper electric motors, and we're in business. The Germans are working on seasonal energy storage. They're storing cold in the winter and heat in the summer. I went up to Princeton one time in the late 70s in the era of oil embargo business when we were worried about energy. And I pulled into the Forrestal Lab parking lot, and there, this is in January, is a garden hose spurting water into the air. So I went in and asked the faculty that I was giving a seminar to, I said, what are you doing out there? And they said, we're making an iceberg. And we tent the iceberg in the summertime and we run our air conditioner off it. If you go to Cornell, they have a lake. And they tap into various levels of the lake depending upon, what they need for temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We have not begun to be as clever as we think we are.
Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, no, I totally appreciate it. And you, of all people, you're also considered, and I didn't mention this, a futurist. I mean, you're part of the World Futurist Society, and you're part of that cutting-edge small group of people who are always looking forward to what's next and disrupting the current paradigm. So it's a pleasure to hear you begin to share with us some of those forward-looking technologies and research that are taking place like this. It's fascinating. What, in light of the larger arc of conversation regarding global warming leading to, accelerated climate change, and I very much tend to frame it that way, what are the other elements that you think that we could do as a society that will help to roll back the ill effects and advance the positive ones?
One thing that may be of interest is we are now changing from the industrial age to the IT age, heading into the virtual age. And in the IT age, we now do tele-everything. We do telework, telecommuting, teleshopping, teleeducation, telemedicine, telecommuting.
Yeah.
Telecommerce is endemic now with printing, telemanufacturing. And people have done studies of the benefits climate-wise of teleshopping. And it turns out, even with the delivery and all the rest of it, that teleshopping is close to 1/30th to 1/50th of the effects on the climate.
Uh-oh.
Not getting in your car and driving around town and spending a day looking for something and so forth. It makes a big difference.
Interesting.
Well, yeah. That's just one little thing. I mean, that's not going to move the market
shopping,
too much, but it's something you know, individuals can do. And you know, as we teletravel, okay, there is now five senses virtual reality: haptic, taste, touch, smell, sight, and sound. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
With five senses virtual reality, you can walk down a tropical beach virtually. You can feel the sand, feel the breeze, and smell the wind. You can do this at any time you want, anywhere you want, be with anyone you want, and do anything you want. And this makes a great vacation. And there's some 100 million people worldwide who are now doing this seriously.
That many. There are only little problems.
There's
a huge population that
does these online gaming.
Well, sure.
It's an even bigger population.
Yes,
okay?
Indeed.
So you know, and if you look at the miles driven per person per year, it's been dropping. And it's been dropping because we are tele everything.
But relative to the virtual reality point, I mean, everything is good except you're actually not gaining the higher quality of oxygen that you would be if you were on a beach in the Caribbean. You may be having the experience of the sand under your feet sensorily, but you're not literally, biologically, biochemically getting the benefit of that sand on your feet, are you?
Okay, we are wet electrochemistry, okay? Some people allege some 90% of our mental capacity evolved to handle the social interactions. The social interactions are going virtual. The effect on our physiology, upon our health, of our mental state is supposedly fairly major.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and
not
if
even
we really need oxygen,
it is.
You know, if we really need oxygen, we can certainly give you a very inexpensive oxygen production gadget to put in your house.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and that's
sure.
a good new market.
Well, no, you know, in the larger scheme of things, what you're saying, I mean, the human body is also not only a chemistry, but in some way an alchemy machine. So if it is oxygen that we need, we do have means of manufacturing it. So
yes.
having the mental state that you were referring to, and it was a quick comment, but it didn't escape me, could actually have the needed effect on our physiology to produce exactly the chemical or the element we need.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, what's happening
is... Do you find that to
is,
be true as a NASA scientist? Not just in, you know, conversation?
Currently, people allege that there's no natural evolution anymore, that the humans are evolving things some million times faster than any natural evolution. One of the things we're evolving is the humans themselves. Physiologically, with CRISPR and designer people and so forth coming along, but also we're becoming cyborgs. We have cochlear implants to hear. We have artificial retinas, artificial hearts, artificial limbs. We're printing organs and brain chips. We have 100,000 people wandering around with brain chips in their head to fix congenitally defective brains, and DARPA's working on super soldiers. Okay, so, you know, what's going to happen to humanity is going to be interesting. The other aspect of this is we are looking at various special life forms, okay, which evolve in deep pools in Yellowstone, under the ocean, everything else, which are able to respond and prosper in very nasty conditions like we're producing with this climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So we can, going forward, evolve the humans if we absolutely have to stand whatever mess we do with the climate.
Yes. Yes. We are extremely adaptable, even though
yes.
we have altered things, profoundly in ways that our hearts and souls are very disturbed about. On the other hand, we do adapt. And when life is most stressful and adverse, we become even better at adaptation.
Yeah, but there are studies that show that the rate of technical change is becoming so rapid that people are starting to lose it. We see an uptick in psychosomatic illness rate. We see an uptick in road rage, workplace rage, school rage, and so forth. We see evidence that the population is getting destabilized somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As in essentially emotionally destabilized, correct? That the variables impinging upon us and the flow of information, it's more like an avalanche, is so great that it is overwhelming human psychology and biology.
Well, think about how we lived two decades ago, before the web, okay, before a lot of stuff. And and then, fast forward to now. If you look at the economy, okay, with the machines taking the jobs and so forth, look at the developing gig economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's massive.
Yes.
With no benefits, with all the other problems with it. Okay. That's where people are going. Okay. When we have this very low unemployment, an awful lot of it is people working for themselves, trying to sell stuff or provide services on the web.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not 5 or 10%. It's 3 or 4 times that.
Yes. 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 Well, that's there are a whole slew of sociological and psychological reasonings, I think, behind that, as well as economic. But people are feeling that we've been, this is moving our conversation in some way away from what we started out with, but nonetheless,
of course,
it's interesting and impactful. We live in a corporatocracy, and it's having some very ill effects, and the younger generations don't want to abide by it. That's one way of looking at this movement that you're talking about, the gig economy, and people not wanting to be participating in what was the status quo for so many decades.
It's not so much, in many cases, a question of not wanting to participate. It's a question of that's the only way to earn a living.
That's another thing. I think it's some combination of the two. It's complex. And it's also brought together with the fact that more and more people can't even afford their own home or even their own apartment or house to rent. So they're staying with their families for longer periods of time. So,
yep.
Everything is skewed from the way it was, really, as you're saying, just 20, 25 years ago. There's been a rapid change.
We're probably almost out of time. Do you want to get back to halophytes?
I do. I'd like to. I was going to use these comments as a way of circling back to it so we can make the final points about the benefits in the job market as well as, in business and industry. Here we're showing, in a sense, from this conversation, how far astray we have gone from, what were the norms just 20, 30 years ago. And now we have the presence of an entirely new space for exploration. No pun intended, speaking to a NASA scientist. So could you just elaborate upon that just a few more minutes? That would be fantastic.
Yeah. There is.
Pardon the bad puns,
movement.
I can't control them.
There's a movement arising which is like the 60s, early 70s, back to the land movement. Before the industrial age, there were very few jobs. People lived on their own holdings and so forth. Jobs are an artifact of the industrial age. And
yes,
we're now moving away from jobs. The gig economy is kind of a halfway job. You can, on a half acre, and there's 6 acres available to everybody now, on a half acre, grow your own food. You can do your own distributed generation for electricity and cut the cord. Many people are doing that now.
Mm-hmm.
You can also do your printing for, you know, whatever you want to make going forward.
3D printing?
You can do telemed, tele-ed, and by the time you get through doing all of this, you don't need a job.
Yes. The cost of living has been driven down, you're saying.
I have a good friend living on the top of a circular bluff in southern Utah, not connected to anything except electrons. Works fine.
Yes. Uh-huh. And it cost him almost nothing to live.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful example. And so the advent and the furtherance of Halifites that would be both providing, let's say, business opportunities, not necessarily jobs in the classic sense, but entrepreneurial potential, and all of the so-called downstream benefits ecosystemically, it's like the biggest gift we could possibly explain and or explore at this point in time.
Perfect.
Dennis Bushnell, a total pleasure to have you on today and to look into, explore, and use our imagination together to discuss these very vital matters. I so appreciate all the work that you have been doing for so long and continuing to bring it to the foreground. So my great thanks to you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We'll have to continue this. That was Dennis Bushnell, scientist from NASA, who is deeply involved, as you just heard, in new approaches to environmental issues. And with this subject of halophytes and its development, has hit upon, you could say the mother lode. That's very much what I gathered from the work that he's been doing. And I want to say a big shout out and thank you to my dear friend and colleague Hazel Henderson, who kindly introduced Dennis and myself, and whose work in ethical markets continues to roar forward and make such a contribution to the thinking and to the education across the world in regard to renewable energy and the promulgation of a green economy. So, Hazel, thank you so much. So that's it for today's show. I want to just thank all of you for tuning in and paying attention to these very vital matters that can really help to create sustainability and vitality for us all here on planet Earth. Remember that we are a 501c3, so any extent of contribution you can make to us helps us to survive and thrive on the air. Our website, again, is www.abetterworld.tv, and to get in touch with me directly would be at my direct personal email address of mjr@abetterworld.net. That's MJR, my initials, @abetterworld.net. We also offer a series of very healthy organic nutritional products and different types of stress management, energy balancing, and coaching services. So just visit us at our couple of websites, abetterworld.tv. Get on our mailing list if you're not already, and mitchellraben.com. So thanks again for joining today. I so appreciate it. And forward this to your friends and family and colleagues so they can get the benefit of it as well. So on that note, thanks again. And this is Mitchell J. Raven signing off. We'll see you next week.